This is The Beat, a podcast series that keeps you in the know about the latest community policing topics facing our nation.
Hello, this is Dr. Deborah McCullough with the Cops Office. With us today is Stacy Coleman, Executive Director of the Animal Farm Foundation and the National Canine Research Council. Stacy is here to talk about police and encounters with dogs in the field. Welcome, Stacy.
Thank you very much.
Stacy, can you start by telling us a little bit about the Animal Farm Foundation and the National Canine Research Council, and why is there a focus on educating the law enforcement community about canine behavior?
Well, sure. I'd be glad to tell you a little bit about our organizations. Animal Farm Foundation is a private, not-for-profit foundation, and we are headquartered in upstate New York, and that means about an hour and a half due north of New York City. And as part of our work at Animal Farm Foundation, which is an advocacy organization, we realized that there was a real lack in science-based, fact-based information that supported the human-canine bond. So we acquired and developed further the National Canine Research Council. And through that subsidiary of the foundation, we research, publish, and promote information that supports the human-canine bond, putting a great deal of emphasis on the humans involved in the human-canine bond. We sometimes forget and get focused on the dog as if the dog holds some mystery or the magic solution for when encounters between humans and dogs go wrong. But we like to take a look at the human behavior, too, that has led up to that. And which brings us to the next question, which is, why is it important to educate law enforcement about canine behavior? Well, law enforcement, they are out there on the front lines, and their encounters with dogs are oftentimes high-stress events. And so what we want to do is help officers stay safe and also keep the people in the community and the dogs as safe as possible when they have those high-stress encounters. And we'd like to do that in this video series that we've developed with the Department of Justice and Safety Maine Chicago. Our focus was a lot on how police can diffuse a situation with a dog where their behavior is what will lead the canine to relax and hopefully not pose a threat to anyone at the scene.
Before we continue, you talked about a video series in your response. Can you just tell our listeners the name of the series?
Sure. The name of the series is Police and Dog Encounters: Tactical Strategies and Effective Tools to Keep Our Communities Safe and Humane. And it can be found on the Community Policing Learning Portal site.
Great, thank you. So when an officer has to quickly assess a situation involving dogs, what are some of the assumptions that might come up about the dogs or their owner's physical appearance and their location?
Well, let's be honest about it here. There's a lot of publicity about particular dogs and particular dog behaviors. There's a lot of media coverage that points us to a breed of dog as a good predictor of behavior. But science and experience tells us that's just not so. So, like I said before, law enforcement officers place themselves in harm's way to keep the rest of us safe. And an officer doing that kind of work and then is surprised by a dog might even fall back on assumptions that he or she has heard from someone or read in a newspaper or saw on television. And what we'd like to do with this video series and the work with the Department of Justice is we'd like to help replace those assumptions with the assurance that what we know about dogs to be true is that there is absolutely no evidence that dogs of a certain physical description are more likely to threaten or injure a human being than any other dogs. And officers keep control of the situation and will keep themselves safe by approaching each dog as an individual rather than as a breed or as based on its physical appearance. And that goes wherever he or she finds the dog, wherever the officer sees the dog. When we react on the basis of stereotypes, it seems to me, at least, that we are likelier to aggravate a situation than if we keep control of it and do what we came for, which is to keep everybody safe at the scene, and we'll do that best when we consider each dog as an individual. And one of the things that's interesting that we've learned in our work, which is surprising to so many people, is that when we look at a dog, we're only seeing 50 of its genes. Dogs have about 20,000 genes in their genome, and there are 50 genes that have the ability to change, which will change the dog's physical appearance. And of those 50 genes that determine physical appearance, none of them influence behavior. So we're giving ourselves some false information, and we're acting on misinformation when we look at a dog and make a judgment call based on that dog's physical appearance. And, you know, the same thing can be said for dog owners, too. In the video series, it's interesting, and I think it's the second one, when the officers involved in the training session are learning how to read dog body language. One of the officers even said that he was surprised that the dog that seemed most aggressive during the training session was a dog that he would have considered the traditional family pet, and that was just based on the dog's physical appearance. So what the officers learned in that session is that judging the dog on the basis of looks was giving them an incorrect information starting point, and they were much better off looking at the dog as individuals. And another concern to have, too, when we make judgments based on physical appearance is when we're writing reports or documenting information about a particular dog involved in an encounter. The physical description of a dog is going to be much more accurate and helpful in report writing and in a court case if you're able to say the dog was a particular color or an estimated size, where if you speculate on breed or breed mix or use breed or breed mix as justification for an action, then science is probably going to be able to disprove you, since we are often incorrect when we look at a dog and guess at its breed. So there are a lot of consequences to making determinations based only on physical appearance.
That certainly is one of the consequences that those assumptions can have on police and dog encounters. Are there any other consequences or even other factors that might come into play that could increase the chance of having a severe or fatal encounter with a dog?
Let's get to some good news first. The reassuring news is that severe and fatal encounters with dogs are very rare. They just don't happen very often. And second, severe and fatal dog bite incidences are multifactorial. What that means is that there is not one thing in particular that explains those incidences. And in fact, a new study that appeared in the Journal of American Veterinary Medical Association, on which National Canine Research Council was a co-author, examined each and every dog bite-related fatality that occurred in the United States during a recent 10-year period. And in that study, seven important factors were identified, and all within the control of dog owners. So what we're saying is that for an encounter to go so badly that a human is fatally injured, there are many factors that are in control of dog owners that could possibly prevent those. And four or more of those factors co-occurred in 80% of the incidences that we investigated. And of those factors, breed was not one of those factors that was identified. And in fact, in the incidences that we researched, there were 20 different breeds of dogs that were identified as being involved in the dog bite-related fatalities. And, of course, to get all of this, they had to go beyond news accounts to sources close to each case. And this is the research involved in this recent study. And those sources were law enforcement, the people on the ground who investigated these dog bite-related fatalities. So the result of this study comes largely from reports written by and interviews with law enforcement. And so what we have learned is that when encounters go badly and someone is severely injured or killed by a dog, there are a lot of different factors that play into it that lead to these circumstances, and breed is not one of them.
Stacy, has there been a rise in the number of dogs being shot by police?
In our research leading up to this video series production, we did not find that there was actually an increase in the number of dogs being shot by police in the line of duty. But what has happened is there is an increase in public scrutiny around these events. Lots of people have camera phones now and cell phones on them, and they're able to videotape and record these incidences in real time. And it's this public scrutiny and this availability videos that show officer behavior that is really leading the public to think twice about what is acceptable and what isn't when it comes to police officers encountering dogs in the line of duty. And this puts police officers in a really tough position, and we recognize that. That's why we want to give officers as many tools as they can to defuse the situation before they have to resort to the use of lethal force.
For officers who have a fear of dog bites and attacks, What information is available to help reduce unfounded bias against these physical attributes and locations and reduce the premature and unnecessary use of force when they encounter dogs?
Well, the really good news is there has never been an officer who died in the line of duty as the result of a dog bite-related injury. And an officer can almost always maintain control of a situation. He or she can communicate to the dog that they are not a threat. And that information, we hope, is conveyed clearly and concisely enough in this video series that we're going to be able to help law enforcement officers who are responding in these high-stress situations to diffuse an encounter with a dog. We don't expect officers to be dog trainers. There's no need for officers to be dog trainers. There's not even a need for officers to be well-versed in dog behavior. What law enforcement needs to know is how to diffuse a situation with a dog in a high-stress event. And Brian Kilcommons, our dog behavior expert for this video series, will surely go into more detail in this. But what I can say is that what we're learning and working with officers in the training is that the behavior that we use to take control of a situation with humans may not be the same behavior that's needed to take control of a situation with dogs. The good news about dogs is they don't lie. They're going to tell you exactly what they're feeling. There's no ulterior motives to dogs. All we need to do is recognize where a dog is in this particular moment and control their behavior by controlling our behavior. And, of course, the safety of law enforcement and the safety of people on a particular scene is paramount. It's far more important. But I think that we'll be able to prevent such tragic incidences of family pets being shot in the line of duty if we just look at each dog as an individual.
Where can listeners find this video series?
The video series can be found on the Department of Justice COPS Community-Oriented Policing website. You can find a link to it also on our website at www.nationalcaninesearchcouncil.com.
Thank you, Stacy, for talking about the work that you're doing with the Animal Farm Foundation and the National Canine Research Council.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. We hope that this podcast has been helpful and that officers will take advantage of the video series. And also, we'd be happy to support police agencies if they'd like to explore in-person training as well.
The Beat was brought to you by the United States Department of Justice COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems.
The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.